Luke chapter number 9. Luke chapter 9 is where we are at this morning as we continue on our series, Every Day with Jesus. The book of Luke is in the New Testament. So if you have a paper copy of the Bible, and you open it to the middle, you come across like Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. You just keep going to the right, come across eventually Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or just pull out your phone and Google Luke chapter 9. That will help you. We want you to follow along and see right from God's Word what it says this morning. It's good to be back with you. We enjoyed going on our adoption celebration cruise together as a family. It was great. It was taxing. It was all those things. And so, what could go wrong? Take 8 people on a boat. It'll be fun, they said. So, but we had a great time. We got to watch one of the services just with the spotty internet and whatnot. It's one of the weirdest vacations. Typically on vacation, we always go to church somewhere. And so this is like one of the few places they didn't have a chapel. They didn't have a service. They didn't have anything. So we got to watch and listen to Pastor Derek do a great job on Lord's Table Day. And so glad to be back with you. We always miss being here in the assembly as well. Luke chapter number 9 is where we are at, and we're seeing this shift of Jesus doing all his miracles and teaching and showing his authority. He's going to shift and show that through his disciples now as we continue on in our journey together in the book of Luke. So Luke chapter 9, I want you to look at verse number 1, and look what Luke records here. Then Jesus called his 12 disciples together and gave them power and authority over all devils and to cure diseases. And Jesus sent them to preach the kingdom of God and to heal the sick. Jesus said unto them, take nothing for your journey, neither staves, nor scrip, neither bread, neither money, neither have 2 coats apiece. And whatsoever house ye enter into, there abide, and thence depart. And whosoever will not receive you, when you go out of that city, shake off the very dust from your feet for a testimony against them. And the disciples departed, went through the towns, preaching the gospel and healing everywhere. Now Herod, the tetrarch, heard of all that was done by Jesus. And Herod was perplexed, because it was said of some that John the Baptist was risen from the dead, and of some that Elijah the prophet had appeared, and others that one of the old prophets was risen again. And Herod said, John have I beheaded, but who is this? Of whom hear I such things? And he desired to see Jesus. And the apostles, when they were returned, told Jesus all that they had done. And he took them and went aside privately in a desert place belonging to the city of Bethsaida. This morning, we're talking about a taste of things to come. A taste of things to come. It reminded me to some degree, seeing what happens in this passage, both great opportunity but great obstacle. It reminded me of my wife and I during COVID, we started doing these workout videos together. And so we were doing these workout videos together. We're being really diligent. I mean, what else could you do during COVID, right? So we're being diligent. We're getting up. And we start watching this YouTube fitness person doing these workout videos. I remember one of the early ones we're doing, right? We're doing this workout video, and we're going through this circuit. And I'm like, man, this is tough, but it's good. And so she's like, all right, all done. I'm like, yeah, all done. She goes, all right, circuit 2. And I thought to myself, are you kidding me right now? What do you mean 2? We just finished. We're done here, right? But those early videos with those, what I thought were hard but good circuits, built up to where we could do more over time, right? So those early ones were just a taste of what was to come, both an opportunity but an obstacle as well. We come here to this passage, and Luke, like we said, have been demonstrating again and again the authority of Jesus, the ability of Jesus, the power of Jesus, and we know he's writing to Theophilus to demonstrate that over and over again. Here, he wants Theophilus and his Gentile reader base to recognize the mission of Jesus was greater than their traditions, greater than their polytheism, and who he would use is the everyday person to accomplish his great mission. So he's previously selected the 12 to be the foundation of his kingdom work for the nation of Israel, but then also to become the foundation of his church to include the Gentiles as well. Until now, they've been what? They've been eyewitnesses. They've seen what Jesus has done. They've heard what he has taught, but they personally have not accomplished anything besides being in his presence and being an eyewitness to the miracles happening over and over and over again. But in our passage, Jesus is going to shift that. He's going to take the impossible for them and work it through them. And by doing so, the acts of Jesus and his apostles are going to be inexplicable. And it's going to garner attention, yes, from the people around them, but even more importantly in our passage, we realize it garners the attention of Herod. He's an ambitious and wicked local politician. So in this brief passage, we see Jesus giving the disciples a picture of what was to come for them as his church in the future and how their mission would be interpreted by the unsaved around them. Jesus' unique authority enabled the disciples to share the kingdom mission, but it also made them a threat to ungodly rulers. And if there's an idea to walk away with as we look at Jesus enabling the 12 and getting Herod's attention, here's the idea to walk away with from the passage today. What Jesus can do through your life for his kingdom far exceeds the greatest accomplishment you could aspire to in this realm. What Jesus can do through your life for his kingdom far exceeds the greatest accomplishment you could aspire to in this realm. This morning, I want that thought to kind of stick in your mind as we see the lives of the disciples, the life Herod was chasing, and see what God does through 12 ordinary, diverse men in his estimation, in his economy, versus what Herod was chasing and accomplishing in this realm by mankind or humanity's economy. First thought today, as we think about Jesus giving them a taste of things to come in his lordship, is this. Because Jesus is Lord of all, he can enable anyone to accomplish his mission. He's showing them a taste of what's to come in his usage of them and through their life. And he's showing that in his lordship, he is able to do anything through anyone. And that's what we see through verses 1 through 6. In verse 1, Luke says, Jesus calls them all together and he endows them with abilities they didn't have and would not have if it were not for him. It's like any one thing else. You can only do, yes, what's in your scope of ability unless somebody enables you to do far greater. If I give you my debit card, you are capped at a scope, right? But if you had ties to the Kettering family here and all that old money and they give you one of their debit cards, your ability just far exceeded what you'd have with a Norton debit card, right? Here's the same idea. Jesus is supernaturally empowering these ordinary men with his unique abilities that he's been demonstrating to them, but now they will actually experience it firsthand in person at their own doing. What power did he give them? Well, we read it. He gave them power over the demonic realm. Now pause and think about that for a second. Have they seen it happen? Yes, they have. Did it astound them when it happened that Jesus had that kind of power over the demoniac of the Gadarenes, right? They watched that and they were like, this is unbelievable. Now they're going to do that. What was impossible and unbelievable to them, they're now doing themselves. They had power over earthly diseases because of the curse of sin. They would be able to walk up to crippled people and make them whole, restore sight, do whatever was needed if somebody had an impairment or an ailment. And not only that, they had the authority to proclaim an unbending message of hope. It's unbending in that it's tethered to the message of Messiah, which is inclusive and exclusive. But it's a message of hope because it's for anyone. These abilities seem to have only been granted for the duration of this mission. It wasn't going to be just a constant from here on out. So having been taught by Jesus and armed with the knowledge of what he wanted them to teach and preach, they go out to proclaim this message. But I want you to think about how challenging it had to be. We sometimes, again, read this a little flat. Jesus commissions the 12 and they're to go out. And yes, they have these incredible powers and incredible opportunities. But think about how different it would be. Mark's account records it this way. They're paired up by two and they were to go out. What I love in Mark's account, it doesn't say, and Jesus paired them up with the other apostle or disciple they really liked being around. If you've ever had a coworker that you didn't enjoy being with, imagine being with them on a team for a long time, right? Not exciting. Some of you saw some family members this week that you're glad you only see once a year, right? Here they're getting paired up two by two, maybe with somebody they don't even care for, and they were then to go out, and what were they saying? Hey, here's the message of Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah of Israel. They're giving this oral account of what has been taking place, and people are just sitting there listening to them. It's not like they pull out a Bible, or it's not like they're just going out, they're telling the message, and they're doing miracles. The validity was tied to the miraculous signs and wonders that had been prophesied about and were taking place currently in the ministry of Jesus, the Messiah. So consider then, if that weren't challenging and difficult enough, consider the scope of the requirements Jesus gives them. When you read this taking place, it's like there's no way. You're going to not only go out and do all these things, but here's the restrictions I'm going to be putting upon you. What were the restrictions? Well, he said it. Don't take any spare money with you. Don't take a spare walking staff with you. Don't take anything that could be used as a weapon for your protection. Don't take any extra clothing. I want you to rely upon the hospitality of others. For some of you in the room right now, that's got to be the most unnerving request possible, right? You're going to have to go and ask people to take care of you at their own expense. Can you imagine being that person rolling into town doing that? Some of you planners right now are just cringing. Well, right, but what did they do about this and this? Yeah, that's right. There was no option B. There was no, well, let me go to the knapsack and pull out. If that weren't enough, they knew they were going to hit rejection because Jesus told them, when rejection comes, here's how you handle it. So go out, pair it up with somebody you don't care to be around perhaps, and go armed with oral tradition and with the ability to do some miracles I'm empowering you to do, and don't take any of the following. Rely upon others, knowing it's not yours to make it fruitful. I'll take care of that, but there will be people who reject you. It's hence the idea of shaking the dust off their feet, showing that they receive the condemnation they have garnered by rejecting the message of the Messiah. It's important we recognize this is to some degree a great template for you and I to be helped by and encouraged about when it comes to the mission of Jesus in our life. We're reminded Christianity is not a worldview of coercion like Islam or by cultural pressure or by family birth or ethnic origin either. It's an individual decision that is then verified by submission to the faith community in your church. Here they are going forward in an impossible scenario as ordinary, average people empowered by Jesus to accomplish his work, and yes, they're going to face obstacles and opposition. Why would Jesus do that? Why would he make his disciples go out with a difficult mission with stringent requirements? I thought Jesus was supposed to be kind and loving and helpful, right? Why would he make the 12 go out even to hostile territory in this manner? Consider what he's trying to emphasize and teach them that they need now, but is a taste of things to come that they'll need in the future. They need to have contentment with his care, don't they? Don't take all this stuff, because what I have for you is sufficient. You don't need me there. You have the truth. You have my power, you will have my provision. He needed to teach them reliance upon him. Really, they're going to be living out what he teaches them later on in John chapter 15, right? I'm the vine, you're the branches. Without me, how much can you do? Nothing. He reminds them of this through this exercise, if we can say it that way. He was teaching them thankfulness for his provision through others. Though hospitality was commanded in the Old Testament for the Hebrews to practice towards each other, regardless of their ties, regardless of their connections, they were to have hospitality. They were going to have to go and be satisfied with whatever level of care was granted to them. Can you imagine you roll into one town and you end up with somebody hospitable, but on the lowest end possible of hospitable, like the bare minimum? And then you meet up with one of the other pairs. Hey, how was that city? And they're like, you would not believe the dinners we had. And just sitting there thinking, Jesus said just to stay put, but boy, I'm thinking, you know, right? Jesus is wanting them to learn thankfulness for his provision and trust that his work is being accomplished even if they don't see the fruit. Really, they're living out not only what he will teach them in the future in John 15, but what he has taught them in the past in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember the model prayer? They were to do what? Give us this day our what? Daily bread. Jesus was using this formative time to build the disciples, yes, a taste of things right now, but a taste of things to come. Pentecost was coming in the future. All the world being evangelized in their area was to come in the future through the missions on and on and on, through the churches being planted and multiplied on and on and on. Those were all to come, but they had to go on this now. But secondly, because Jesus is Lord of all, we realize that his agenda ends up being at odds with powerful people in this realm. The disciples are going out, things are happening, accomplishments are taking place, but that gets some buzz. That gets some announcement through people. And we're introduced in verse 7 to Herod. Who is Herod, we might ask? Because in the New Testament, there's a bunch of Herods. You know, it's kind of like being in a Catholic community and meeting a Joseph or a Mary, right? On and on, you can meet those people, right? Herod was no different in their time. A lot of Herods in their time. This is Herod Antipas. He's the son of Herod the Great. His dad was the one who ordered the execution of all the infants in Jesus' birth time because he heard from the sages that there was a powerful ruler being born. And so what did he do? He called for the execution of all the infants to make sure this ruler never came to pass. Nothing ever happened or took place. So that's his dad, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as we see. Herod assumes a role there in the Roman political structure, allowing for Jewish people in it. And he's ambitious, and he is immoral. We see him asking a question that is asked about Jesus, and frankly, is just kind of a foreshadowing of what's going to be in the future asked. He hears all that's taking place. He's like, who is this? Who is this Jesus doing all these works? You see, Herod is confused in his mind because of what he's hearing about Jesus and his followers, because he knows what he did to John. Remember, Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, had been preaching about righteousness and the kingdom. And what does he say? You, for taking your brother-in-law's wife and murdering him, are immoral, and God will judge you. And what does he do? Well, here's what I can do in my power. I can take you and imprison you. And ultimately, at the whim of an immoral woman, he ends up executing John the Baptist. So Herod knows, I killed John the Baptist. I know that. So how are these wonders taking place? He's hearing all the rumors. Is John the Baptist back from the dead? Is John the Baptist, I'm hearing it might be Elijah risen from the Old Testament. It could be one of the other Old Testament prophets back from the dead. And here's what makes me just kind of like, think about this Herod for a second. He hears everything being done. And you know what his first reaction is? Is somebody who's a spokesperson for God back? Think about that. Is John the Baptist back? Is Elijah back? Is one of the Old Testament prophets back? He was familiar with the Old Testament. He was familiar, maybe I say it this way. He was familiar with the Bible of their time. He was familiar with God's work through people throughout their history as a people group. And yet, his response is not, I should probably check myself. I should probably hear this message out and respond to this message and see what the God of heaven has to say to me. If these rumors are true, then I may have made a grave mistake in rejecting the message of John the Baptist and in murdering him. I may need to repent. Instead of repentance, what do we find? Pushback. Why does it even matter to Herod who Jesus is? What matters to him, because his role's been granted him by Rome. So his region he took care of was granted to him by Rome, and it came with very simple requirements. Make sure that the tax revenue stays flowing. and make sure that Pax Romana, Roman peace, stays in place. If you can keep the money flowing, and you can keep civility, we'll let you be there, and you can do whatever you want to the people there. You can extort as much as you want, you can be as moral as you please, but if these two things start to fluctuate, well, now we're coming from you, you're easily replaced. And so he's hearing of Jesus. He's hearing of this power. He's hearing of the possibility of some of his authority being taken by or being seen as in frail in view with Jesus. And so it's his responsibility now to make sure that this rival doesn't go forward at all. He doesn't want to be replaced or eliminated. So Herod, rather than respond to the message of Jesus by saying, "What does this mean for me in light of standing in front of God?" flips it the other way. He desires to see Jesus, not to hear the message, but in order to understand how big of a threat is he to my goals, my aspirations, the life I'm building, the plans I have for me in this realm. This issue for Herod is that it's the greatest pinnacle he could ever hope to have is this realm. The biggest goal of his life he has been building towards, and he's finally got this etched out section. I'm finally at least a tetrarch in the Roman cog, in the Roman Empire cog, and I can keep working my way up bit by bit, clawing bit by bit to build the life I want, to build the life I deserve, to build the life I've always dreamed of. I could have money, I could have influence, I could have success. And so he is just clawing his way up this ladder, and those are high dreams and aspirations he has. But there's this Jesus fellow and his followers doing a bunch of stuff that seem to be running contrary to my plans and may even upset my plans if they go unchecked. The reason he's threatened is because what Jesus is teaching and because what Jesus is doing rivals, even it exceeds what? His ability as a tetrarch. What Jesus' disciples are now doing and saying exceeds his authority and ability as well. What the masses are being exposed to with Jesus of Nazareth shows somebody superior to Herod and even the whole Roman Empire. Jesus is greater than him in his role, his opportunity, his goals, even greater than the Caesar himself. Jesus and everything about him and everyone following him is in direct competition to Herod, both in power and authority. Maybe we could try to visualize it like this. Imagine a local sheriff understanding and recognizing the scope and reach that the CIA has. I mean, those are two different realms, aren't they? Some podunk sheriff from like Dukes of Hazzard days. There's a few old folks, right? That's a meeting with the head of the CIA. What can you do on your end? Well, we got two cells at the local county jail. That's great. We topple whole nations, right? It's just wildly different. And that's what's taking place here. Jesus is a direct threat. And so Herod keeps asking the question that will be asked repeatedly, who is Jesus? See, Jesus' message has always been at odds with mankind or humanity's idea of glory and fame and power and worth. Think about it. Humanity looks to political leaders for safety, for security, to find value and promises. Humanity looks to net worths or titles to try to find security, provision, and promises. Humanity looks at professional degrees to try to validate their value in society or their place in society. Humanity looks at achievements for value. Humanity looks at all their career milestones to say, we did it. This is how great we are. This is what we've accomplished. This is how special we are. Humanity looks at relationships in their goals or their statuses to say, we have value. They maybe even look at something like having a family to say, we have value. Now, some of the things I mentioned are not intrinsically wrong necessarily, but it just shows the frail goals we can have and aspire to here in this realm. Jesus in his message defines those issues, and we are to be subservient to him in this realm, serving a greater realm. But people who reject the message of who Jesus is find themselves at odds. The greatest that they'll ever aspire to will still be frail, and it will still be easily removed. It's still at risk. It still has a short-sighted vision or goal. Jesus here is trying to show the disciples, you're going to have great opportunity, but you're going to keep coming across people like Herod over and over again, that know the message, that hear the message, and will keep pushing back against it, chasing after something frail and foolish, like 60, 70, 80 years of life on this earth, thinking that's the best there is and the best that they'll ever have. Lastly this morning, because Jesus is Lord, all his followers are able to grow in their trust of his ability in their lives. So Jesus is using ordinary people. They are facing obstacles because of unbelief and rejection around them. And yet they see God do incredible works that grows their trust and faith in him and what he's able and willing to do. So the disciples return to tell Jesus all that had happened. This always makes me snicker a little bit, like as if it's news to him. Like they all come back and they are just on level 9 or 10, right? They are just turned up to the max. They're like a bunch of toddlers on too much ice cream, right? I mean, they are just hyped up. And they come back to tell Jesus. And I can't think of it for certain or say for certain because we weren't there. But it doesn't seem they come back and they're like, so we did some cool stuff. And tell me about it. Oh, you know, went to some villages, killed a few folks. Yeah. What'd you do on Tuesday, right? Yeah, I kind of did the same. All right, there's your recap. I think it's more like this. It's like if you've been a parent or a grandparent or aunt or uncle talking to one of your children, grandchildren, nieces, nephew, and them relaying something they loved and enjoyed and were excited about, but you weren't present for. Ever been down to that? Like one of my daughters this morning told somebody, we were on the boat, and guess what? I fed 100 sharks! Well, she did not feed 100 sharks, but her excitement enthusiasm level was enough to convince you maybe that she had, right? I would love to have been there to hear them come back and see what Jesus has been showing and what Jesus promised would happen actually came to pass. And was the rejection an obstacle? Yes. Did they have to trust him and rely upon him as he said they would? Yes. But he was faithful. Consider how this helped build their faith. They've been asking the same question that Herod's been asking. Who is this Jesus? And this is what Jesus uses to help build their faith. We're going to see it here in a few weeks. Jesus is going to say to them, hey, who do everybody say that I am? Who do you hear that other people are saying I am? And then he says directly to them, who do you think I am? You see, he sends them on this trip with this empowerment, knowing the obstacles, because he wants their faith so deeply rooted and convinced about him that they can go forward with his message even when he's no longer going to be around. He knows it's coming. He's been telling them it's going to come as he goes forward to the cross. They seem to continue painfully ignorant of that. But here in this moment, Jesus used it to teach that they were going to be privileged to enjoy his power, his authority, and his ability. Though they were completely inept, he was going to do the impossible with them. It's kind of like when a barely 500 football club topples a top 10 football team. It's kind of like that. Just making sure you're still listening. This ultimately would be an account we could say is the disciples going through an apprenticeship, or maybe even what we want to say is a short-term mission trip. Jesus empowers them, sends them out, their faith has grown, and this is going to be crucial. Why? Because Jesus knows what's ahead. He knows what they're going to face as his followers. He knows what they're going to face at his trial and how they'll respond. He knows what they're going to face at his execution. They know what he knows what they're going to face with his absence before the resurrection. He knows what they're going to face after his ascension. He knows what they're going to enjoy but face with the empowerment of the Spirit and the message that needs to go. Go to all the foreign areas they've not been. Leave comfort and convenience, familiarity, and go. He knows also that this message is going to create more than rejection. It's going to create suffering. It's going to create persecution. And for even some of those gathered there with him, some of those 12 are going to face martyrdom for it. They needed this mission before they could embrace the scope and totality of the mission. Their faith had to grow. So Jesus empowers the 12 to live a life far beyond the aspirations of this realm, facing the difficulty and obstacles, because he was going to use this for the next stage and the next stage and the next stage. So as we close, I want you to have a few encouragements to think about for your week. I want you to think about this first. The only prerequisite to being greatly used of God, and let me define that, greatly used by his definition, not yours. Greatly used by his understanding and his economy, not your and I's definition or understanding. Because you might be standing there right now, and as soon as you see that on the screen, he's like, greatly used? I'm just a plumber. What does that, I work at Waffle House. I don't feel like I'm really Billy Graham right now. I sell products at Ulta Beauty. I just don't really feel like I'm going to be greatly used of God. Hold up. The greatly used is defined by him, not by you, not by me. He understands what he's willing and able and is doing in and through your life and my life in this realm, even if it doesn't seem like we aspirationally have climbed as high as we could have in this realm by men and women's understanding. The only prerequisite is what? Making yourself available. These 12 were not uniquely talented, financially able, or educationally astute necessarily, not all 12. In sports, they say it like this. Your best ability is what? Availability. Availability. These men were available, tenderhearted, and faithful. At least 11 of the 12 were. We know that. But here's what the devil loves. Discouragement. He loves to push back with his hellish narrative, spewing thoughts into your mind and into my mind that we are inept, unable, handicapped, limited. He tries to focus on all the things in this realm we think stand in our way of being used by God. He wants us to have a narrative so trapped also in this realm's thinking that we think our life can't, won't, or will never make a huge difference or splash for him. But that's the devil's lies. Here, Jesus uses 12 very common people to do an incredible work that he would keep doing an incredible work through. So this week, don't let the devil get you down about what's going on in your life. Don't let the devil beat you up about maybe a past decision, even if there are some lingering consequences. That happens for everybody at a level. Remember the prerequisite of God. Are you teachable? Will you be? Will you make yourself available? Then he can use you in a great way. If he could use the 12, and we get to read what knuckleheads they were, if he could use the 12, he can use you and wants to use you as well. But then secondly, encourage yourself with this week and be reminded, this realm and its glory is just frail and at odds with Jesus and what he offers. What do you mean, Pastor? It's important for us to remember as brothers and sisters in Christ that why it's not wrong to be successful in this realm or make advances in this realm or graduate with this in this realm or accomplish that in this realm or sell this or make that or get to this network or this level of success in this realm. Those things aren't bad and wrong in and of themselves, but they're not the goal. They're not the goal. Guess what they're not? The goal. The goal is, even if we are in the midst of those things, it is not necessarily wrong. The goal is the mission and message of Jesus. His plan and his purposes always exceed the greatest aspirations we could ever have in this life. And I would even put it this way. If we get trapped to pursuing and giving our efforts and our time and everything about our thought process, structure, and worldview to living as much as we can in this realm that is frail and frankly very stupid compared to the glory and kindness and goodness the Lord has in his plan to make an eternal difference. So let's continue by remembering that at some level, we, if we're following the Lord and his aspirations in this realm, you're going to face opposition by unbelievers at some point. You don't have to go around like the disciples did, healing, to get attention and pushback from unbelievers. If you and I follow him, living for him, for his glory in his realm, seen in this realm, you're eventually going to have pushback by unbelievers. And I would say a good gut check would be this. If you can't remember the last time you faced some rejection or uncomfortable moments for being a Christian, what's going on? You heard that? What's going on? I hope Thanksgiving was a little awkward for you at some level if you had unbelievers with you. I hope so, right? I hope things are a little awkward at times with your boss. I hope things do get a little bit weird with your coworkers sometimes because you're a believer and they're not. Because that would be a healthy, helpful moment to be reminded, if I'm living on mission for Jesus in this realm, I'm going to have to eventually come across someone who's not. And there's going to be a bit of friction. There's going to be some frustration. There's going to be an obstacle there. And they're not my enemy. There's somebody for me to keep loving and reaching and investing in and giving pathway after pathway after pathway with the gospel. The final encouraging thought. What Jesus is currently doing in your life is stretching your faith and becoming an anchor for your faith in the future. What he's doing right now is intentional to change you, to grow you, to transform you, and make you reliant upon him in a greater way. But it's also a building block for what he's going to do in and through your life in the future. God calls all of us to grow in faith, to act in obedience, and see his great work done in our life. This is daunting, isn't it? It's intimidating at times when God does this in and through our lives because it demands we rely upon him rather than what we are comfortable with and how we've done things in the past. And it calls us to trust him and not ourselves, not our fear of man. But as his grace enables his work, through our faith-based obedience, our trust of him, and frankly, our value of him and of his realm and of his ideology, that grows, that deepens, that is strengthened. That depth pushes us to new heights of maturity for the next gospel endeavor he has lined up in our life that we're just not even aware of yet on the horizon. It prepares us for life in the local church to continue the gospel work and mission through the church. It prepares us for how to aid and practice the one another's with each other. There are brothers and sisters sitting in the room right now who have had their faith stretched and it has become an anchor and a building block of maturity and grace in their life that you are going to benefit from because God worked in their heart and life first. You know what one of the beauties of Christianity is? There's no pecking ladder or pecking order. Is there a pecking ladder? You get the idea, right? There's no pecking order. That's a better thing. Pecking order or a ladder that pecks you. There's none of that. You can meet a brother or sister in Christ who's 15, but has grown in grace in ways that maybe you haven't at 43 yet. And you'll meet somebody at 72 who's not grown in grace in something that you have at 41. And you're 37 facing something that somebody who's 27 is facing, and then you're going to grow together in that. See, God stretches our faith, but then that becomes a building block and anchor for the future. Think about 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul talks about it. God's the God of all grace. He's the God of all peace. He's the God of all comfort. And what does he do? He comforts us in the tribulations we go through. And it's not short-sighted just so I can get through it, though Jesus is very, very interested in that, of course. The end result is that you, and I'm paraphrasing, will be greatly used to help others when they go through the same thing in the future. The 12 were going through what they were to be prepared for the future. Peter wasn't going to be ready to go through what he was going to go through in the book of Acts and beyond and be martyred if he wasn't enlisted and empowered, enabled, and faced the obstacles in the short-term mission trip from Jesus now. My friends, I want us to be reminded and encouraged. What you're facing right now in both obstacle and an opportunity, Jesus is using to stretch your faith. It's not just for now, it's for the future as well. So it begs us to ask a few questions. What are we pursuing with our time, effort, career, possessions, and money? Aspirations for this realm exclusively, or Jesus' work through this realm? What do you believe God is able and willing to do with your life? If the devil is a master of discouragement, then we have to go back to what's true about our God and about today, not what happened 13 years ago, not that one choice you made last week, not what somebody else did to you 18 years ago. What does God want to do in your life this week? And then maybe let's ask the antithesis to that. What's the devil trying to stop you from doing? What does he not want you to accomplish this week? If Jesus is desirous to empower the 12, there's a reason it got on Herod's radar, right? Because the devil is looking to stop all that Jesus is desirous to do in and through your life. Listen, he's Lord of all. And what he's doing now in your life is a taste of what he will continue to do and more in the future, just as he did the 12. So the greatest thing you and I can ever do is submit ourselves to him, let him do his work in our life, and that will exceed anything else we could have chased after in this world. If you're here today and you don't know what it is to have a wonderful, real, vibrant, daily relationship with Jesus, to have clarity about your death, where you'll spend eternity, to have clarity about this life with his comfort and his help and having hope, today's the day and you're in a good spot. You're in a good spot. He's not here to try to force some idea on you from a Baptist church or some pastor's perspective. We want to show you with confidence what you can know right from the Bible about who Jesus is, how he loves you, what he wants for your life. You can pillow your head tonight with confidence and clarity. That's what we want for you. That starts with the conversation. Even if you have objections, frustrations, questions, those are welcome. Let's start that conversation today. In a moment, we're going to have what our church calls an invitation. I'm going to invite you when we stand to walk out to the foyer where there'll be men and women ready to help you. If you're watching online, stay put for like maybe 2 or 3 more minutes. Watch this video about who Jesus is and then email us, reach out to us, call us, text us, Facebook message, whatever it is. We want to start that conversation with you as well. If you're here today as a Christian, look at the 12. Be encouraged. They were just frail people like you and I, and God used them in phenomenal and great ways, and he wants to use you in the same way as well. Doesn't mean we're going to go out and heal and do all that. No, goodness. He's going to use us, though, with his message to help and invest in people's lives. So let's stand together, our heads bowed, to give ourselves an opportunity to respond. I'm going to pray, and if God's working in your heart right now, drawing on you, and you want to talk about Jesus, walk right out. Now's the moment. Walk right out as I pray. People want to help you. If you're here as a Christian and God's stirring in your heart, maybe there's some discouragement you've been encouraged about today to let go of, right now, let it go. If right now you're facing some obstacle from some unbelievers in your life, right now realize that's part of it. Jesus will sustain you through it. So I'm going to pray, and let's respond. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for your word. Thank you, you're good. I pray for any of our friends here or who are watching online who aren't your children yet, don't know what it is to be your follower. Would they take a step today? It's embarrassing, it's difficult maybe to take that step, but when they take that step and start asking questions about who you are and what you want for their life, whether young or old, man or woman, been here a little bit, been here a long time, whatever it is, may they be stirred, may they go ask, may they not have rest in their mind. And I pray for my brothers and sisters that there could be discouragement from the devil today running rampant in their thoughts. If they're haunted about something currently or from the past, they thought today, well, that's nice for the 12, but it's not for me. May they be reminded it is for them today. You're using their life and want to use their life in greater ways than they understand. Or maybe there's a brother or sister facing a bunch of obstinance and rejection from somebody they love or somebody they work with or somebody they care for. They're discouraged about it. May they be reminded you're working behind the scenes in ways they maybe don't know, and fruitfulness was never theirs to have to create. May they be reminded to be a faithful witness and encouraged about that today. God, do your work in our lives. We know you will. In the name of Jesus.